Hello, and welcome to The Art of the Cut. I'm Steve Hallfish. I'm a feature film and documentary editor, and for more than 7 years, over 300 interviews, I've been interviewing the world's top editors. Today, we're talking to Joe Walker, ACE, about the editing of the highly anticipated film, Dune. Dune is based on the 1965 Frank Herbert novel. The book is epic in scope and filled with mythology and plays out across eons and multiple planets. Not an easy thing to try to harness into a film. As you'll hear from Joe, creating a compact, cohesive, compelling cinematic experience was not easy. Joe and I go back a long time. He and Mark Sanger, ACE, were the very first two interviews I did for Art of the Cut. I was originally intrigued to interview Joe because of Lupita Nyong'o's Oscar acceptance speech for 12 Years a Slave, where she actually thanked Joe for his stewardship of her performance in front of an audience of millions. I needed to meet the editor that gets a shout out from an Oscar-winning actress. Joe was also nominated for an Oscar that year for his work on 12 Years a Slave. Other interviews with Joe included Sicario, for which he was nominated for an Ace Eddie, Arrival, for which he won an Ace Eddie, Widows, and Blade Runner 2049, for which he again was nominated for an Ace Eddie. Prior to starting his feature film editing career, he worked on many projects for the BBC in his native England. Joe's work on Dune holds a lot of secrets for those wanting to become better editors or even just better storytellers. If you're interested in reading this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for film professionals of all types. And I'm very proud to announce that this interview is available as the very first video podcast of Art of the Cut, which is embedded in the Frame.io article and is also available on Frame.io's YouTube channel. But for your listening pleasure, here's my interview with Joe Walker, ACE. Both of us know that this is not a medium that one person does. It's a team, it's collaborative. Tell me a little bit about the people that you worked with on this.
Well, working on Dune's, you know, really like working with a well-oiled team. It's like a well-rehearsed band. You know, I think of the days of Frank Zappa and the Frank Zappa band, the touring band. They could turn on a sixpence, and that's sort of what we've got and what we've got to play with, because over the years, you know, we picked up our favorite people and we like working together. I first started collaborating with Hans Zimmer in 1988, before he left for Hollywood on his last picture in the UK. So we go back a long time, and sometimes the ideas flow between us. I mean, at one point I remember Hans saying, you know, is the scene as good as it could be between Leto's demise and the discovery of the ring? There's a little moment in the film. In any other situation, I think people would go like, you know, he's a composer, what the hell? But we're all collaborative like that. Who knows where the idea comes from? And he was right, there was a better way of doing it. And we found a way of intercutting it. We went away and just took it seriously. I've got a team where I can just get on the intercom and say, can you pop in please? Or can we talk during the pandemic? We were texting all the time. And you could just say, hey, I need the sound of a Sardaukar guard. I need it sort of like, let's get going. And then people would record their own things. I mean, I would record my own things. There was times when there's a spider, a human spider in the film. And at one point I thought, actually the thing that really makes it, the detail that makes that thing really creepy is the way it's pushing a bowl around on a concrete floor. So, you know, I went down to the garage and spent half an hour recording me pushing a bowl around.
Did you have to do it with your nose?
I had to do it with my nose. I had to act rubber spider or whatever. There's so many things where, who knows where the thing comes from. From Hans, we got the Sardaukar voice at the beginning of the film. Everybody's collaborating. We get musical sounds from the sound design team to say, okay, we need to try out this line of dialogue rather than that. And I'm kind of a firm believer in constantly building the thing up detail by detail. But you might as well make sure it works repeated times before you get there.
And you mentioned that Marianne Faithfull is a voice in the film?
Yeah, there was this idea. You know, there's in the book and in the film, there's this concept, the voice, which is a hypnotic command. And that took a little while to get right. I think the ingredients of it and the ideas for that came out of lots of discussion and trying things out. And we, very early, the first idea was like a kind of bass thump that went with the voice. It should be sort of summoned and you should be able to hear kind of the ancestry. part in the book, you know, Paul's skill is that he's the first male Bene Gesserit in a way. He's able to kind of reach to the past. And you could do that in sound terms by recording the words that he uses to command somebody with layers and layers of different witches' voices. And for that, we recorded two or three people. Gene Gilpin, who's amazing, and just did endless sessions for us. And Marianne Faithfull at one moment, she recorded some stuff for us. You can just hear her actually in the wake of Charlotte Rampling's voice, which gives me great pleasure because I think they were old drinking buddies in the 60s, back on the King's Road.
There's a very interesting interview that I found on the web where he says he can't edit without you being in the same room and that it's kind of like you need to be like a band. Can you talk to me about that relationship you have with him and why can't he just be on a Zoom call or some remote thing?
You know, we started off in Budapest together and I was there on set, and then afterwards we moved back to LA and worked in the office, and then the pandemic hit and we had to kind of close down and everybody ended up working in garden sheds and spare bedrooms and mother-in-law flats across the town. I had to get used to seeing the front of his face, which isn't something I was very used to. I mean, I've sat to the left of him for so long, it's, you know, the right-hand side of his face is like the dark side of the moon to me. So. The edit of this film somehow happens in the air between us. Mm-hmm. And it's partly periods of identifying what a problem might be and then finding the solution, which often takes a shorter amount of time than finding what the problem is, really discovering why isn't something ticking as it should be. And on a film like this, on these kind of scale of films, thank God you have the chance. And the pandemic, I have to say, was very kind to us to give us some time to kind of really think without the great heat of a schedule bearing upon us for a few months, just to dream a little bit and follow our instincts and develop things, which we did a great deal.
Being in the room is really important. And what is going on that you have to be with him?
A lot goes on in the cutting room, not necessarily to do with cutting a film, but creating kind of a safe space for a director to work in. And also to immerse yourself in a sort of sense of what film did he want to make. You kind of really need to touch base with the kind of core decision to make the film at some point. You need to kind of go back to the beginnings. And in Denny's case, you know, the fact that he discovered the book when he was 13 or 14, I sort of actually, I wouldn't say it was a psychological ploy, but I did at one point get some comics that he'd been talking about from those days. There's this amazing Belgian comic who had this thing, Blake and Mortimer, and I just left copies of it around on the table. And at one wonderful point, a friend of his, Nicola, was a great friend of his from back at that time, and the two of them discovered Dune together, and they dreamed together in Montreal, some, you know, suburb of Montreal. They were dreaming already about Dune when they were 13, 14, and to my great pleasure, Nicola came one day. And that was a really special couple of days where I felt I was sort of in touch with the Ur moment, the original moment, where boys in a bedroom dreamt up this kind of fantastic thing. And it was a time when we were experimenting with the opening and different versions of the opening. And I remember it was just a particularly great creative mood in the cutting room. There's long periods, there's like days where sort of stuff doesn't seem to be happening, and then masses happens in one afternoon. And especially when I can kind of call upon Theo in the next room to give me a kind of Bene Gesserit singing voice or a Charlotte Rampling sound alike, and Mary to give me this and Harry to give me that, and this kind of team that we've built together. We all can turn on a sixpence and to serve this little burst of creativity. The psychotherapy, I'd say, is mutual.
Did you read the book before you did the editing?
It's so funny. I've met so many people on this project who said, oh my God, I read Dune when I was 12 or 13, and it's a really seminal book. For me, no, I didn't. I didn't actually pick it up until Denny started talking about it. We were in the middle of Blade Runner 2049, and he mentioned it, and he said, you should read the book and tell me what you think. And I read it. I was very engaged. So I'm a late adopter. I read the book before I read his script, and I did think he'd you know, he'd bitten off a lot. I mean, we're in the middle of Blade Runner where, you know, we're walking on sacred carpets cinematically, trying not to mess them up. And I think, you know, the idea that you go from that to Dune where, I mean, the fans are going to come with their baseball bats to that is what Denny said to me. So, no, the book is really, I think it's a magical book. And I think it's very timely, amazingly, for a book written in the late 60s. And I think it has lots of things. I could totally see why it captivated Denny. It's sort of got many themes that he's interested in, and the environment, and the sort of relationship between women and power, I think, is a big ingredient. He discovered the book when he was 13 or 14, and there's elements, a strong element of that response to the book in the film. A very small example of that is that in the interior dream vision sequences, we use a kind of connecting device, which was a flare. There's flares which were a layer that was, I got hours of material from the VFX team where Denny had seen the camera chip responded to the light in a certain way, strong sunlight, and it was unique to that chip. And he just asked them to film into the sunlight and slowly move. So I had hours of hours, but beautiful material, which is in the film a lot. It feels a little bit like, you know, when you're a 14-year-old kid and dreaming and in the summer and your eyes are half shut, exactly, your eyes are half shut. And you have, it's a sense of almost your eyelashes at one point with these beautiful striations of light. So I kind of feel like, I don't know, the film is very much in touch with that 13, 14-year-old perspective on the book. And of course, the central hero is a 15-year-old guy. So I see a lot of why Denny responded to it.
What about the movie?
I saw it a long time ago. I sort of deliberately avoided watching it again. I haven't seen it since I saw it in the cinemas when it was released. Let me just say this. David Lynch is, you know, he changed my mind when I was 18 to such a degree. I saw a Razorhead in in Screen on the Hill in London.
So many
on Friday
cinema
night.
Students of our age, right? Eraserhead.
Yeah, there's no going back after that. It's just you spend such a profound amount of time rethinking everything you knew about the moving image. Mm-hmm. So I have the utmost respect for him. I don't think he was happy with his Dune. But, you know, honestly, the main source for us was the book, and only the book.
Most people know this. You guys are not trying to cover the full scope of the book in this film. Did you feel like that was the right choice? Did you feel like, oh my gosh, we don't want to try to cover too much?
I think it was Eric Roth and Denny who picked the lock, if you like, of the book and worked out a way to divide it. No, I thought it was very, I mean, I think it's incredibly wise. There's so much depth. I mean, the thing about the film is the detail. And, you know, Herbert isn't, I mean, there's a difference between a book and a film, as everybody knows. But, you know, a good example of this is that Paul Atreides is known by 5 or 6 names in the book. It's like the Bible. There's many words for God in the Bible. And I think it's a kind of almost deliberate Frank Herbert, almost like a fractal approach to storytelling, that's how it works in the book, and there's density of detail. That's not a necessarily cinematic thing. I think a very typical cinematic thing is simplicity and economy. And we were looking for that in the cut, but also paying, you know, our dues to the book and also to the depth of that imagination that Frank Herbert originally had. It felt important to always pay attention to the detail, never let it pass by. As an editor, you could easily find low-hanging fruit to cut if you wanted to shorten the film, but you would have lost a lot. I mean, there's a little scene that I love, which is where Paul Atreides meets a gardener on Arrakis, and he sees the palm trees, and the gardener explains the sacrifice that's made to keep these palm trees alive and to keep an old dream alive. Of a dream of the planet to once again, you know, have water. It felt like a real kind of great way to encounter the Fremen kind of concepts and Arrakis itself, and, you know, his inquisitiveness actually saves him in the film. It's adapt or die in the desert. So, you know, you could cut that, but you'd lose the depth and the storytelling and the world building. And in this film, I don't think I've seen any other film that has got this level of world building as an editor, it would just be foolish to disregard that.
You don't want to rush from beginning to end.
Yeah, I think they're always narratively driven, to be fair. I don't think there's ever like just a beauty shot.
Oh, no.
It's always, I mean, a good example, there's a shot in a kind of engineering yard, which is where you know that we're about to go out into the desert. And it occurred to us relatively late that we should show how a carryall works, the idea of a spice harvester in the desert. And there's a shot, and it shows you the thing successfully picking up a spice harvester. And the very first concept of that was actually somewhere on my iPhone, I've got a picture of Denny's hand picking up a box of matches or something and and just showing how long it should take, just for me to get some idea of how long a shot should be. I got him to act it out.
And you filmed it, and did you actually cut it in?
Oh, yeah. I put such nonsense into this cut.
Tell me a little bit of the Hunter Seeker. There is this scene where Paul's reading this book, looking at this kind of hologram thing.
It's a nasty little bug that's been released through a hole in the headboard of his bed. And everything designed around that is, you know, I love the design of that headboard, the fish, which a reminder of water on a desert planet. And anyway, it pops out and it tracks him. And it creeps around the room and it makes a rather nasty little silvery noise. One component of which was my assistant Mary's voice pretending to be a fly. For the longest time, I've just got plates. I've got empty plates of the empty room, maybe with a kind of camera pan or a tilt up. And you're kind of going, how long? I'm where the storyboard and the previs and the action finds rhythm and time. That happens in my hands. So you're trying to kind of find a way how long to hold for this thing. And especially because it's really creepy when it's slow. If the thing just darts out and kind of dits around like this, it's not what we wanted. We want something very sinister and to take our time to show Paul seeing it and sweating. So the visual reference of the word Hunter Seeker Go, and it also is helpful for the VFX team. There was an amazing guy, Patrick, and my VFX editor, Javier, who worked together in the background to then take those and turn it into the first pass of this little bug moving through. They replaced my words with the bug, thank God. But I'm also using the sound that Theo's made in that case. I won't use music too much in the early stages of a cut. Later I will. On this film, we had really great temp tracks put in by Clint Bennett. Peter Miles, two amazing music editors. So I've got a great team of people who are chipping into this sequence to help me find the timing. And then at some point, it starts to form, you know, like that's getting close to where we want to be. And that's when the proper VFX team is briefed and given the more expensive task of doing the real thing. Dune, if nothing else, is for me one massive work of rhythm. I studied classical music at York University, and it wasn't Baroque music or anything. It was nasty 20th century, you know, Stockhausen, Stravinsky, Berio, Lutoslavsky, Ligeti, all those kind of, you know, brutal. It's not surprising I get on with Denny and for his tastes and things. When I was writing music, it's not so dissimilar. There's many things, you know, I was pushing things around with a mouse and originally on an Atari ST using MIDI files and things. And then you start developing a kind of a sense of what's foreground, what's background. And there's a lot of similarities, but the main thing is pace and rhythm. And this, to me, is like, I'd say editing was slightly more enjoyable to me in that it's also, I've got the additional benefit of performance and working with this amazing cast. So that rhythm could be the sound of a thumper, or it could be the raising of an eyebrow by Stephen McKinley Henderson, or, you know, the rhythm of the cuts itself, or the kind of global, bigger tectonic plates moving underneath the story, that kind of rhythm. It's got an interesting rhythm, this film, because it starts actually quite gently and builds up your interest in the characters. And then I think it's accelerative and becomes very dynamic.
Let's talk about those tectonic plates you were talking about. What was that structure, and did the structure change throughout the film from the script?
Absolutely, a lot changed. I mean, the best way to talk about it, rather than talking about the kind of created a sculpture, so I don't want to focus too much on the rubble on the floor. You know, we're striving for certain things. I mean, I feel this is an edit, is kind of a bit of a partner piece to Arrival in many ways. I mean, Arrival, Blade Runner, and Dune all use a simple trick, which if you go from somebody looking very intently and cut to something, then it looks like they're thinking about it. So with that simple trick, I've carved out a little niche in Hollywood. You know, in the case of Dune, we wanted those inner visions to be awoken really early in the film and then carry through right to the end so that they're more than just cutting away to something, but they're evolving and they're part of a narrative. They're essential as an understanding of what he's seeing and how he's grasping events to take place yet to come. So feathering in the idea of a knife and feathering in the idea of Jamis, the character of Jamis, feathering in the visions of Zendaya's character, Charney. They're all important things that took shape in the edit. I'm always going to say they were in Denny's mind. We always knew that we were going to do them, but just how? And to be honest, we kept doing that for the longest time. We worked on the little flashes that you see in the Gom Jabbar scene early on, right at the end of the schedule, when I think we were a day or two away from the final mix. There's a lot of the last days, you know, where you're told to put your pencils down. Actually, there's always like another day.
Where you're told to put your pencils down. I can relate.
We went beyond that a few times. I mean, no, the schedule never suffered. You just risk irritating the sound team to change things. But it was essential at one point to say, those flashes that he sees right at the beginning, we need to pay them off right at the end. And so in the middle of a fight at the end, that was one of the last things I did. I think it was literally a day or two before I had to kind of give the drive back.
One of the beautifully edited scenes that I wanted to talk to you about was fairly early in the movie. I will call it the give me the water scene. And there's imagery that's not on the table. You explore the rest of the room. Mm. You're showing color and world building, as you said. Yep. Can you talk about that sequence?
So there's a little moment where his mum is badgering him to practice the voice with her, to make him command her using the voice. It's kind of a nice dynamic to set up his training, his Bene Gesserit training. The other reasons for cutting around the room, it was to kind of create a sense of hypnosis, something happening in the room. And I had, you know, how did I kind of mark that scene out? Well, I had those shots. We didn't know exactly where to put them, but there was a shot of the grandfather who's died in a bull charge or something like that. And there's a little sculpture of a bull, which we see later. And it sums up something about the Atreides, that they have a certain pluckiness. They like to stare disaster in the face, which sets up their rather wanton acceptance of fate when they take on the role of governing Arrakis, knowing that it could be the end of them. Just to depart from the point briefly, you know, I think Denny responds to that plucky British thing from the Blitz, you know, that they go sort of charging into danger rather crazily. I also think there's something of the British in India, in Arrakis, I would say. It's my personal comment. I don't know if he intended it, but when they arrive on Arrakis, you know, you've spent so long establishing the world of water and the world of this beautiful, lush planet, Caladan, green planet, and then you cut to a horrendous, hostile oven. And they look like as white as the British arriving in India, you know? Maybe he doesn't intend that. I don't want to claim that for him. Back to the voice, talking about the voice. So we've got the scene where he's commanding his mother to hand him a glass of water. And we cut round. We wanted to set up the bullfighting grandfather and the little sculpture of the bull. And there was a beautiful chandelier or some tinkling glass, and I found a sound just out of a sound library that helped me create a certain dreaminess and a certain spaciness. And then, you know, we spent a long time on his face just saying, okay, this time I'm really going to try it. And then actually the experiments, this evolved over months, but we found this bass thump thing. Originally, the plan was to have a bass thump at the same time as he says, give me the water. And actually, I discovered that we needed to tell a story longer term, which is that he's learning. So you hear the And then you hear witchy voices saying, give me the water. And it almost works, but not quite. And that contrasts with when you meet Charlotte Rampling, who's high-level Bene Gesserit skills. She says the thump and come here at the same time, and it's really impressive. And he's like swept across the room within a 24th of a second. And very much later, it pays off, I think, in the tent, where there's a scene where he tells his mum to get away from her. And, you know, that's done with the voice. And that was like all this stuff we discovered.
I was thinking about that with your story about asking about the palm trees, because later on in the movie, you see those same, I'm not going to give anything away, but you see those same palm trees and the shot means something to you because you've had this earlier shot that's happened.
They're burning, yeah. I can say.
Yeah.
They're burning. And so all of that hope and all of those dreams are kind of kicked by the power. There's a tragedy to that.
But like you said, you could have easily cut that scene out. It didn't mean anything to the real story. But then you've lost some kind of emotional energy.
Here's the thing. I think with Denny's films, it gives me a chance to play with something super, and it's very hard to find the word for this, but I would call it brainstemmy images. It's appealing to some part of the brain that's old and not necessarily verbal. It's not necessarily front lobal. I don't know what the hell it is, but I can describe those images. I can give you a list of them in the film. And they're all very sensory, incredibly sensory. A really good example for me, one of my favorite shots in the movie. It's weird that your favorite shots aren't always the biggest shots. Mm-hmm. But one of my favorites is the shot of Lady Jessica waiting as the bull is being packed into a packing case and she's about to leave her home for all of her life and step onto a planet where death and disaster awaits. And there's a moment just focused on the back of her neck and you feel her anxiety. And then Oscar Isaac's Duke Leto's hand comes in and reassures her. And it's the hand on the back of the neck, which we all know what that feels like. And it's, for me anyway, it's been a, you know, favorite part of my life, that sensation. But also what it says about the trust between those people, it's so much bigger and more beyond a whole scene. It's just one shot. It's finding a way in the edit to kind of give those images the best pillow, you know, the best placing, the best timing. And actually it's rich. The film is rich in these sensory moments, whether it's a foot on the sand for the first time or whether it's a hand in water. There's lots of images that actually connect together in some way that I can't even begin to fathom, but I just know they work.
Some of those moments had beautiful sound design under them. Was there also a thought of giving the sound team or Hans a place to, you know, explore a little playground, a little sandbox for them?
Oh, totally. I mean, there's a moment where they arrive in the desert and they're on their own. Lady Jessica and Paul have got to traverse the desert to find the Fremen. And I needed, in story terms, I felt like a strong need to kind of say, we need to set up that the next obstacle is worms. We're in the desert and we're in the deep desert. And these things are the size of a tower block or a skyscraper. And they follow rhythmic noise. I just felt like it was important to make a kind of big statement. Denny had shot this extraordinary landscape shot looking into this kind of flat expanse of sand. It's 17 seconds long, which it doesn't sound like a lot, but actually at that point in a film, you know, you're very conscious of the fact that your audience is waiting for you to get a wiggle on and resolve this story. They know it's going to resolve, they just don't know how. And we've got this last big obstacle before there's a resolution. So it's kind of a little bit daring do to put in a shot the 17 seconds. And especially when it's in the initial stage, it's just a plate shot. And with me saying, no, it's going to be fantastic. And in the initial stages, it's just a plate shot of the expanse of desert. And I was saying, no, we need to feel the music come to an end. Then we need to feel like a roar underneath. And then wait for it and then erupt and then collapse and then see the collapse and then cut. You know, it has to have these sort of four or five beats within the one shot, which in the initial stages, it's just a beautiful GV of the desert. It doesn't have that narrative element. So how do you build it up? You know, maybe at that stage we're using temp tracks. Also with the sound team, I'm saying, okay, this is what it's going to be like. And that's, you know, I'll put a little red dot and say, that's when we first see the worm erupt. That's where we're going to see the sand collapse behind. You build it up with the use of the team. Another good example of the team coming together to design things was in the scene with the Gomjabar, the test, and Mum's outside knowing that he's either going to walk out or not, and she fears he's not ready. So you have that scene, but I remember cutting it, we were developing this little inner vision. We wanted the idea of the Kwisatz Haderach to be born. It's what the elderly Reverend Mother is looking for. She's looking for his ability. The idea is, you know, there's a lot of backstory, and this is to do right by the book. It's all there, that Lady Jessica wasn't meant to have a son. She was meant to have a daughter. And the Bene Gesserit arrive on the planet to say, if you're not up to the task, then we're going to kill you. If you can't control yourself like an animal, you got to go. So the test is, there's a lot going on in the scene. And in the kind of moment of duress, we flash inside and something resilient, something really powerful, which is already inside him, is revealed to us, the audience, and to her, Reverend Mother. And building that scene, we had shots we wanted to use, including burning palm trees and some sense of the future. But also, there was this tiny little fragment of sound that had come in very early stages. Hans gave us pieces of music, and they weren't necessarily destined for any particular scene. We just had this fantastic music. We were kind of going, that could go here, that could go there. And that was at a stage when we had about 5 or 6 pieces of music. And in one of the tracks, there's a singer called Loire Cutler who recorded this chant in a wardrobe in her apartment in New York. It came from all the teams, sound, music, me, Denny, VFX, everybody working together to try and kind of make these little focal points, develop them hand in hand. I mean, it wasn't like we finished an idea and then hand it over. It's like we do it all together all the time and keep finessing it until it's just right. It's a path that takes sometimes not long and sometimes a long time. Oddly enough, actually, the scenes that we probably spent the longest time on were dialogue scenes, like the scene between Lady Jessica and Paul in the tent.
And why? What was the thing that you were trying to achieve that wasn't happening in the first cut?
That scene has flashbacks, flash forwards in it, and flashes of visions, I don't know what to describe them as, and also the dynamic between when you're on him and when you're on her, and getting there, and the time it took, and the sense of the fact that there's spice in the tent. There's so many story beats that at some stage could have been told more successfully, and then we found a way of telling it more successfully. Some scenes honestly didn't change at all. There's a knife fight in the film that is the same as, is frame accurate, the same as 2 days after they shot it. It was a big shoot, and I have bins and bins and bins of material, and I put it together, and it honestly never changed. Denny isn't one to kind of kill something and just change it for the sake of it. If it works exactly how he wanted it, then that's it. And he's put a lot of work in to make sure it works before they even shoot it. He saves his energy for the scenes that need more work. And one of the most important things, it doesn't matter how great the world building is. If you don't care for the central characters, then we might as well go home.
Was that part of the structural changes that occurred in the film? Was a feeling that you needed to set something up early so the audience cared later?
Always, yeah. And a lot of discussion about that. How do you start the film? It's difficult. And again, here we go. We started with a little Sardaukar voice, and that has a kind of significance because they seem like good ideas that you might have just come up with because that's the idea, but actually they're often in relationship to a task that you've discovered. And one of the tasks that we discovered was setting up the Sardaukar. And I think in some way we wanted to, there's so many factions in Dune, you know, you have to set up the Harkonnens, the Mentats, the Atreides, the Sardaukar, the Emperor, 3 planets, and I don't know how many characters. I think about some of the films that I've cut where it's basically what, like, you know, Shame is a guy and his sister and his boss. if you really want to get into outer space of his character. But the central film, Shame, is about two people. This is really much more kind of epic, the scale. It's like a proper novel. We felt at one point it would be a good way to start the film with some hostile, aggressive act. And actually that came from Hans. That sound, which is sort of dialogue, but it's actually a throat singer and did all sorts of transformations too. And we loved it. There was at one stage a longer version of that, a kind of really bloodthirsty poem at the beginning. But, you know, we go into a dream vision of a battle between the Fremen and the Harkonnens, and we set up the idea of spice. I mean, I think we got the optimum way of starting the film, but there are so many ways of starting this film, and we did consider most of them.
How do you maintain objectivity?
The best thing is weekends. Our industry is in need of that for numerous reasons, but the reason I most need it for is to get away. Alcohol is definitely beneficial. Look, I was cutting at home, and I'm not going to say, hand on heart, that I didn't occasionally have a whiskey late at night while cutting Dune. But yeah, you know, for me, working at home was fantastic. There are things that are worrying you. You haven't fixed them. You've got a deadline. And like, rather than worry about it and stay awake at 2 a.m, I'd go downstairs and go and cut something for half an hour, solve the problem, go back to sleep like a baby, and then get up in the morning. So all those kind of tricks. One of the tricks I've been using is to flop the image. This is just for myself because other people find it very distracting. But at one point I'd black and white and flop the image. This is late stage. If you do this too early, you've blown it too early. But basically by flopping the image, I make it black and white, your brain takes it a different way, and it feels like a fresh viewing. It's a cheat. There's an element that you're fighting against, which the brain is giving you, I think, an endorphin rushes when you see things that you like and recognize and that you see over and over again. A film has its moments that you become very attached to because they're very pleasurable. Your anticipation of them is pleasurable. And it's a bit like a sense of knowing how a song goes after you've listened to it 10 times. And sometimes you have to kind of remove that to get a sense of the audience. And I think the most important thing an editor does is has an imaginary audience over his or her back, driving your decision. What are they asking now? What question have they got? Have we successfully answered that question? Have we successfully posed the question? All of those things are like the most important thing an editor can do. And I feel like, you know, we're in a very privileged position being one of the first members of the audience of the dailies. So you are cutting a scene with that in mind all the time. The easiest cut to make in dialogue terms is, why did the chicken cross the road to get to the other side? And you know that there's a rhythm that's inbuilt in the rhythm of those words that's driving that cut point. Mm-hmm. If you are aware of that simple trick, then you've just disassembled all of my dialogue entity. With Denny, a lot of the time, we will review a scene without any audio at all. We're trying to kind of make it work like a silent movie. If you can, and it makes you hyper aware. When you turn the sound off, you become hyper aware of people's eyes. And I feel like eyes, that's a serious part of what we do, is like driving the cut by the expression in the eyes. And, you know, it's all looking for an efficiency. I'm going to depart from this for a moment just to say that one of my great favorite moments on cutting Dune was working with Hans, and I've collaborated with him so many times. And at one point, he was noodling around on the keyboard and he was trying to kind of find something. And I just said, Hans, what are you actually looking for right now? And he said, I'm looking for a tune with the efficiency of the word fuck. It's a very efficient word. It's international. There's some crazy report somewhere that I read that all nuns who have strokes say the word fuck. It's universal, it's super efficient, but also it's malleable. If you're a composer and you're writing a little fragment that can become a love theme, a chase theme, a worm theme, whatever it is, it's universal. It's something you can say, I fucking love you, or you can say, I fucking hate you. And it's just as punchy and efficient. And, you know, comedians know that it's the kind of golden ingredient that they have to be sparing with, because to other comedians, they don't look clever if they overly rely on it. So you have to kind of be as elaborate as you can. I'm looking for an efficiency too of emotional expression and trying to kind of get out of the way a little bit. A good example I give in Dune is when Stilgar arrives in court. There's a scene where Javier Bardem, much fanfare, we're expecting this guy to turn up. Everybody said, you know, the leader of the Fremen has come to visit us. And so it's all nicely set up. They stand back and they say, in he comes, the doors open, hold on the shot, nice long time. They did this amazing shot of him just walking and not stopping, despite the fact that people are saying, hold there, and he wades through and then comes up to the desk. And I've got this medium sort of close up, medium wide really, of him just taking everybody in and breathing and looking at everybody with mild disdain. And then there's a long pause where you just don't know which way he's gonna go. And he clears his throat and spits on the table. And then knives are out and everybody thinks there's a great offense. That scene, by the way, you know, I've got Oscar Isaac, Stephen McKinley Henson, I've got Josh Brolin, I've got Javier Bardem, and I've got Timothée Chalamet and Jason Momoa. Everybody is acting their hearts out, and there's moments that I could have used from everybody. And there would have been good story points to make if I'd had a shot of Paul recognizing Stilgar. There's a destiny in there. There's so many reasons to interrupt that cut, but I'm glad that we ended up just holding that shot because there's tension to it. Massive tension. You don't know what he's going to do. He seems to hate them all. Then he spits and it's kind of a surprise. I just get out of the way sometimes. That's the efficiency of it. It's less efficient if I'm busy with everybody, as tempting as they are, is what I'm trying to get across.
Tons of great reaction shots you could have used.
Could have used, you know, that whole scene, for example, if the close-up of Stephen McKinley Henderson, who I love in this film, He's such an extraordinary actor that even though he had one line right at the end of the scene, his close-ups could have been used anywhere. In fact, I do. I really indulge myself in him. Because you could play the entire scene on his face. So you've got this massive abundance of shots. I've been in the cutting room since 85. And thankfully, things get better and better and better. And you end up being given this table full of riches. The wisdom is in sort of knowing when to avoid that and to sort of let a moment play, I think. And if you're way too busy driving the cuts, it's exhausting. If you're at the front of an IMAX screen looking at something that's like moving around too fast, I've been there, it's nauseating. This is a film where you have dramatic, violent scenes and they're all super fast and exciting, but you want to kind of be able to look into the characters and feel something.
Do you feel like when you're watching a scene that you're choosing a certain shot size over another? Or like, what are the purposes?
You know, it's a key way to figure out the structure of a scene is to look at all the material and then say, okay, it's nearly always the case that the main source is in the close-up. And you kind of, if the scene has one, that's something where you are trying to figure out how do we get there. And at what point do we get there? Because it's got an intensity that all the other shots don't have. All the other ones are giving you atmosphere and content and performance and everything, all the nice things, but it's the close-up where you really go, bang, that's the point. That's the moment where he realizes, or whatever it is that the scene is doing. And for me, it's always a mental game of figuring out almost backwards, how do we get there? When I see the dailies, I can often see that moment and clearly, and then I'll go straight, jump forward to that moment in the scene and put the shots either side that I need, and then I can figure out how to get there. I sort of cut backwards.
I got a chance to see the lovely place that you get to edit in, at your house. I was surprised by a couple of things. One, tell us a little bit about how you monitored sound. I would figure, man, this movie would need 5:1 surround while you were editing, and you edit on a very small monitor, maybe 32 inches or 24 or something.
Yeah, I mean, my monitor is small, but I'm very close to it. But we also check on big screens. We screen on big screens, and so we're always taking, in fact, we started editing Dune on, you know, full 1:4:3, because a large component of it is shot IMAX. And in fact, the whole of Reel 8, as it was, is from beginning to end is is IMAX originated material. I was very concerned about those moments of transition, and obviously concerned if you were going between two aspect sizes and whether it was noticeable or damaging. And in fact, on the IMAX screen, I was amazed at how free it is. And Denny had already reassured me, I think he'd spoken to Chris Nolan, and that you're quite free to kind of go between 239 and 143. On the IMAX screen, it's so massive, you don't necessarily see it or feel it that much. So I think I was kind of probably overly worried about that. So we started cutting 143, and once we'd felt that we were confident, we flipped over to cutting 239. And very important, you know, to look at that stuff and to see for VFX, it's a considerable more plate for them to have to figure out. You know, if there's a bit of vegetation on the floor that can't be there on Arrakis, then that might be on the foot and you don't see it if you're cropping. So I think it was advisable to look at it, the full aspect ratio as we did our first cuts. But after a while, we zoned in on the 239 and it felt like a more comfortable, less distracting viewing experience for most people. When we're getting, you know, about to show it to the producers and things like that, we flipped over to 239. And audio monitoring, I mean, in the past, I have done left, center, right. And at one point I did left, center, right and subs. The problem with the subs was that it really pissed off the neighbors. So I kind of abandoned that. And also I use rumbles, the rumble sound effect is probably due for retirement. But no, nowadays I actually cut with left and right, only left and right. And the reason for that is I just don't have any throw. If I was in a deeper room, you know, left, center, right, maybe surrounds and sub, I could cut like that. But the problem I have is I haven't got the space where it's melting. So I feel very distracted by the fact that I'll have something, dialogue coming out of the center and a gunshot coming out of the right. And it suddenly feels like, there's a mismatch. It's the limitations of the size of my room. I'm just really comfortable in my room. And I hear enough when we review sound effects, we're reviewing in a 7:1 environment. When we're, you know, there are all these other spaces that you go and test it. At heart, I want to kind of go down to the more minimal, intimate feeling in the cutting room.
Joe, I am so excited that we got a chance to do this video interview about Dune. It's a fantastic movie. I got a chance to see it before we did this interview, obviously, and wow, congratulations.
Thank you very, very much.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, these interviews are available to read at blog.frame.io, where they're supported with great visual content, images, video clips, and more. It's a great opportunity to check out the other expert content on the blog for filmmakers of all types. And definitely check out the video version of this interview on Frame.io's YouTube channel. Thanks to my guest, Joe Walker, ACE. Thanks also to Dylan Giovanetto for editing today's podcast using Adobe Audition. And thanks to Frame.io for their support of Art of the Cut and its pledge to keep this content coming your way. If this is a podcast that you got something out of, follow me and feel free to reach out to me on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Hallfish. And so you don't miss out on all the great upcoming interviews on the Art of the Cut podcast, subscribe to this podcast. And remember that if you have a friend in the film business or who aspires to be in the film business, make sure to tell them about the Art of the Cut podcast and blog.frame.io.